And now, The Low Post.
The Low Post podcast, midday on Monday after Jamal Murray and Donovan Mitchell went molten lava again, and the Nuggets and the Jazz are going to Game 7. And to discuss that and Raptors-Celtics Game 1, the series we've been waiting for in the Eastern Conference forever, I'm thrilled to bring in from 538, genius NBA writer, dabbling in coronavirus coverage, Mr. Chris Herring. How are you?
I think you're doing me too many favors by calling me a genius, but I'm okay. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing my best. Let's start with a very sad weekend in the basketball community, with the passing of John Thompson, Lute Olson, and Cliff Robinson. And let's just start with John Thompson. For the young people who don't know about John Thompson, do some Googling today, read some articles today. This guy was a revolutionary figure in basketball, was a social justice advocate before, as Jay Billis said today, it became cool. And not only was he a great basketball coach, but was enormously important in helping African-American athletes who maybe didn't have other opportunities or were overlooked by other schools. I mean, the most famous example is Allen Iverson. But Georgetown, I saw Chris Haynes and others tweet this. People, when they were young, thought Georgetown was a historically black college because almost all of its players were black. That was the impression that you got watching them. And I will just say, as a kid in the 1980s growing up in Connecticut, as UConn became good, all my friends were UConn fans. I was a Georgetown fan. And I was initially a Georgetown fan because my piano teacher went to Georgetown. And so that was the only college I knew, Georgetown. Then it had a basketball team anyway. But man, if you don't know, Georgetown in the 80s was as cool as it got in basketball. Hoya paranoia, the full court press, John Thompson with the towel over his shoulders looking intimidating and all of that. They were so cool and so good, and he was so important a figure in basketball. It's impossible to imagine him gone. And Chris, I know you're writing a book about the Knicks. Obviously a central character in that book is Patrick Ewing, probably John Thompson's most famous pupil. What have you heard about him in reporting that book?
Yeah, I mean, just how incredibly important he was to Ewing wanting to go to Georgetown. I mean, there were people, it's kind of hard to look at it this way now, but like, people thought Patrick Ewing had the potential to be Bill Russell. He was that good defensively. He was still kind of coming into his own offensively, but basically he had his pick of any school he wanted to go to. I've talked to a number of the folks that were recruiting him, one of whom was Roy Williams, but basically everybody kind of said, in hindsight, they weren't really terribly surprised that he went to go play for John Thompson, but so much of that was probably rooted in the idea that Patrick endured so much racism as a high schooler, you know, coming over from Jamaica. The idea of playing for a coach that could kind of understand some of that. And, you know, when you look at Patrick and some of the critiques of him and maybe why it took so long for him to get a coaching job, and obviously now he's at Georgetown, so you can't really tell this story without thinking about that aspect of it too. So much of it was basically that John Thompson shielded Patrick and other people from the media in part. And I don't doubt that a lot of that was had to do with the fact that sports writers and then and now are, you know, mostly white men, mostly white people that probably can't completely understand that struggle, particularly Patrick and what he was enduring, and not wanting to open him up to that sort of criticism and that sort of misunderstanding on a bigger national scale than what he'd already endured as a high schooler. So that had an enormous effect on Patrick. And like I said, the fact that he now is the coach at Georgetown, it's just a huge legacy. I mean, I can't think of too many people that are more, when you think of one program, that you think of one particular person. I know you mentioned Lute Olson before. I think he's up there too. But when you think about all the things that you consider with Georgetown and the fact that it was misunderstood or thought to be an HBCU, that doesn't happen without John Thompson. And just so many opportunities that he opened up for so many people. And in the coaching community too, how many opportunities he opened up for black coaches.
Yeah, Lute Olson is someone I just don't know enough about as a coach. And to see, you know, Arizona was rising around the same time as Georgetown, you know, a program that came from nothing. West Coast, so like as an East Coast kid, I just wasn't as familiar. But to see the outpouring of all the Arizona alums and to talk about how the way he taught the game. I mean, so we don't really, I mean, college is so much about recruiting and star power and one and done now. Like, we don't hear a lot about these iconic coaches as teachers. So I need to learn a little bit more about Lute Olson. But John Thompson, I can't stress this enough. There were better college basketball teams in the 80s and early 90s. The Georgetown won one national championship. They got close in other years. But the Georgetown Hoyas are and were iconic. They are icons of the sport. That grayish, silverish, whatever color it is, I'm terrible with colors. That uniform is iconic and for lots of different reasons. And so rest in peace to John Thompson. And Cliff Robinson, just a word on Cliff Robinson, former Sixth Man of the Year, one-time All-Star, most famously of the Portland Trail Blazers. That dude was so much better than people realize and remember. He scored 19,500 points. Like, there are guys in the Hall of Fame with fewer points than that. And almost every guy who has 20,000 points and up is in the Hall of Fame. Like, he is this sort of like bench spark plug, and then he starts here and there. Like, people just don't think of him as a flat out great NBA player. And he was a great NBA player. And if you watch those old Blazers teams, and I did a lot of that during The Last Dance, because obviously they ran into the Bulls, that dude would be even better today. He would be a stretch center today, shooting threes, taking dudes off the dribble on pump fakes, switching on defense. He was like an ultra modern big man before, like, people really knew what to make of guys like that. That dude was so good. You're probably a little too young to remember prime Cliff Robinson, but if you watch him, he's so ahead of his time, and yet even so, 19,500 points.
Yeah, no, I came across a clip the other day of him with the Pistons, even, which is like
he was good for the
very end of his career, but like I think it was like a 36-point game he had, just raining threes. And yeah, I've certainly watched a decent amount of 90s basketball, like you said before, mostly the Knicks, and so just kind of watching games with their opponents. But the Blazers were – I want to say the Blazers and the Knicks had – were like 1-2 in terms of record one season. And he just – he was a terror to try to guard. I mean, just long, a lot of stuff that you would associate more so with guys in today's NBA, and someone that kind of – what I've noticed so much from the Jordan documentary, there was just so much about what he was doing, Michael Jordan, I mean, that looked like he belonged, like he hit his head on the backboard in one of those first episodes. And it's just like, he doesn't look like he belongs in that era. Like, he stands out so much because he doesn't look like he belongs. And there was some of that to Cliff Robinson.
Well, also the headband. One of the original headband guys. And I thought it was cool. The Blazers in their last game, I think everybody wore headbands, black headbands, to honor Cliff Robinson. By all accounts, a delightful human being and a vibrant personality. I met Cliff Robinson only once. I can't speak to him as a human being other than what I read, what I see. But the one time I met him was in Summer League in 2014 at Las Vegas. I walked into the hotel that I stay at every year, and in the lobby, 100 feet away from me, was Cliff Robinson. I recognized Cliff Robinson immediately. As a 90s kid, Cliff Robinson's a huge deal. As a UConn, you know, as a Connecticut resident, Cliff Robinson is a huge deal. He helped put UConn on the map. I happened to be wearing a Connecticut basketball shirt. By the way, I carefully choose my Connecticut basketball t-shirts to be either women's basketball t-shirts or genderless, so I'm because I'm much more of a fan of the women than the men. But anyway, just said Connecticut basketball. Cliff Robinson saw it from across the lobby, pointed at me and said, "Yo," and like loped over to me with a huge smile. So I had no idea who I was. We had never met before. Shook my hand, 5-minute conversation. "Why are you wearing this Connecticut basketball shirt? Who are you? What do you do? What's going on?" Like, just, I think he was in line to check in, and checking in Las Vegas is a freaking hassle. It takes 45 minutes because I don't know why with these hotels they need to sell you on every damn special they have. "Do you know where the gym is?" "Yes, I can figure it all out. I'm not going to open the mini bar." He gets out of line to do that. So that's my memory of Cliff Robinson. Mr. Herring, God bless the Denver Nuggets. They don't know any other way, apparently, other than to just be raucously entertaining. Through 4 games, to say they were being humiliated by the Utah Jazz is not an exaggeration. The Dallas Mavericks this season averaged 115.9 points per 100 possessions, the best offensive rating of all time. As Jeff Van Gundy made clear yesterday during Game 6 of Clippers Mavericks, that does not mean they have the best offense of all time. It really means they have the best offensive rating of all time. Through four games, the Utah Jazz were scoring 131 points per 100 possessions.
Good Lord.
Which is like better than the Globetrotters can do against the Washington Generals. They were up 3-1. Before the bubble, some cynics, let's call them, within the league, wondered, what is going to happen when a team gets hopelessly behind in the first round? Maybe not a title contender. You know, they don't have home court. There's no home. I'm not going back home for game three or game six or whatever. Everyone hates the bubble. Bubble is a challenge for your mental health. Is anybody going to pack it in and just be like, you know what? Let's get out of here. Let's just, you know, let's half-ass it a little bit. The Denver Nuggets seemed tailor-made for that. And yet, anyone who's paid attention to this team for the last 2 years knew they would not do it. And in fact, they have come absolutely roaring back behind Jamal Murray scoring 50, 42, and 50 again. And I spent the stretch run of game six last night cackling like the freaking Joker in my office at every single ridiculous Jamal Murray jump shot, punctuated Chris Herring by a steal by Torrey Craig playing big minutes for the Nuggets. We'll talk about their role players in a second. Leading to a 3-on-1 led by Jamal Murray with two guys around him who could have just dunked, and Jamal Murray pulled up for three, one of the most audacious shots you will see even in 2020 when everyone is pulling up for three, and made it. And you're just like, dude, I can't blame it. Just pull up from anywhere you want. So my question to you, Mr. Herring, is and Donovan Mitchell has obviously matched him shot for shot.
Sure.
What can any of these defenses do? What are you supposed to do if you're the Utah? Let's start with Utah's defense. What are you supposed to do with Jamal Murray? They've put Royce O'Neal on him almost the entire series after game one, which the Nuggets won. And he's clearly their best equipped defender to do it. They've tried Donovan Mitchell. Donovan Mitchell's been guarding Jeremy Grant. They've tried Joe Ingles. That's gone poorly for Joe Ingles. What are they supposed to do? What should they do in game seven?
I don't really know. And the funny thing is, looking at it so far in the series, there's an element of this, all of this stuff, that is just like, this is not sustainable. I keep telling myself that, trying to tell myself that, with Mitchell, with Murray, you know, in Mitchell's case, I keep thinking about Denver and just how much they were dropping repeatedly over the course of the series. And you're like, this is not sustainable. A team that would actually step up instead of stepping back and looking foolish repeatedly at some point, or, you know, in the next round, Mitchell won't be able to do this. And there's an element of that with Murray that I think is kind of the case too, that quite frankly, the Jazz don't have a great, great person to kind of put on him. And me thinking that, like, okay, he's getting on a roll like this, but at some point this won't continue. And it just gets crazier and crazier. And it is making me rethink a whole lot of things, probably starting with the fact that I don't remember exactly how I felt, but I remember thinking there's no way that Jamal Murray can kind of live up to this deal he just got. And obviously I've had to rethink that. I mean, if anything, a series like this makes you think he's worth every penny of it. But I don't know. The defense in this series has been so kind of shoddy that I keep thinking that maybe it's that they're not at full strength. Boyan's not probably going to be on Murray, you know, if he's in this series, but you would be trying everything if someone is lighting you up like that. I don't really know what the answer is, but it's making me rethink a lot of things. The fact that the Jazz have such a good backline defender in Gobert, and maybe not nearly enough to really be able to do things about dominant guard play like this. And obviously the same question, you know, has looked true at times when Gary Harris isn't out there for Denver. So I don't know what to think, but the whole thing has been absolutely nuts.
Well, Jamal Murray is like a career 34% three-point shooter. It's not like this is Steph Curry or Damian Lillard lighting it up. I mean, his inconsistency has been his defining trait in the NBA. Right. And everyone keeps waiting for he looks like a good shooter. He plays like a good shooter. He looks like a great shooter. Everyone keeps waiting for him to actually be a great shooter, and now he's shooting 70-something percent at the rim in this series, 60-something percent on long twos, and 55% or 58% actually from three. I mean, it's absolutely insane. And, you know, you brought up, like, this is how insane it is. You brought up Gobert down the end of game six with Utah trying desperately to avoid a game seven. they put Gobert on Torrey Craig, and they put someone else on Jokic. I think they put Royce O'Neal on Jokic, or I can't remember off the top of my head, to try and switch Jamal Murray. They put the two-time defensive player of the year, like, you go hide over there because you can't hack this. We have to try a different way to defend this guy. And I would suspect they will start game seven normally with Gobert on Jokic and maybe try some different stuff that we can talk about. But that's how good Jamal Murray has been. And like, and the same with Mitchell. The fashionable answer is going to be, well, you just have to take the ball out of their hands. You have to trap them. And that's just so much easier said than done, because these modern NBA offenses have so much shooting all over the place. And the more aggressive you get on a ball handler like that, the more teams are going to say, we're just going to load up on shooting. We're going to slip a pass on the pick and roll to the roll guy. He's going to play 4-on-3, and there's going to be 3-point shooters around him, and you're going to get killed that way. But I do think that we will see both of these teams be more aggressive on the ball in game seven.
I mean, yeah, the trap concept, it's funny because it opens you up. It makes you incredibly vulnerable with the shooting that you've got out there, with your opponent shooting. But the other thing is like how loose the teams have been playing at times, certainly early on before these guys just get red hot. They're playing so far back to the point that when there are screens, you're just watching, especially Mitchell. I mean, he's done it repeatedly. People have made the Wade comparison for years. I don't think there's anything that makes me think about Dwayne Wade more than splitting basically defenders that are there. And then when you do that and you kind of break the defense down that easily, then all it is a swing, and you've got an open corner three anyway. And that's been happening so much. So trapping, I mean, obviously at a certain point you have to do that. You have to try it at least a few times. But there are times where they've kind of just gotten what they've wanted so often that trapping doesn't really strike me as a terrible idea based on how open the lane gets with what they're doing anyway. And just
the real answer is you have to do a little bit of everything, right? Sure. I mean, like any scheme that you do over and over again, these ball handlers are too smart. All of them are too smart. They will figure it out. If they know a trap is coming, they have lots of different counters. They can reject picks and go the other way. They can bait you. They can split. They know all that stuff. And I think Denver has done a very good job of that in the last two games, through which they have held Utah to 113 points per 100 possessions. So, like, just short of the best offense of all time. This counts as progress for the Nuggets. But they've dropped back. They've come up to the level of the screen. And their defense behind that has been much better, partly because they're not starting Michael Porter Jr. anymore, who was a total train wreck through the first four games.
Right.
They've trapped some, all of that. And sometimes they'll trap on the side, but not up high. And they'll only trap Mitchell. They won't trap Conley. But you have to just mix it up. But, you know, the other thing is, if you're going to trap, you better freaking trap.
Yep.
And I think that watching the Clippers-Mavericks, even without Porzingis, it was such a fascinating battle possession by possession to watch the Clippers commit to trapping Doncic, one of the best passers in the world, with shooting all around him. And sometimes Dallas won that battle, but it took six passes to beat the Clippers defense, which has some of the best wing defenders ever in the history of the NBA rotating and flying around. But they could beat it. It just took a long time. But part of the reason why it was hard for Dallas, that they at least had to work for it, was because the traps on Luka were really good. They had Paul George, and then they had Zubats. They didn't want Zubats to be up there, but when they trapped with him, Zubats was really good at A, going at him hard. You can't come soft. If you come soft, he's going to have a window and he's going to make a pass early. And if he makes the pass early, you're dead. He came early and he came big. And what that means is arms up, full height, full wingspan. If you're 7 feet tall, use it. And that makes Luka Doncic or whoever. And by the way, Luka is way taller than both these guys we're talking about. It makes him hesitate, maybe take a little half dribble backwards, maybe loft a pass 3 inches higher than he'd like to. All of that gives the guys behind the play time to rotate and recover. But that's the thing. It's because the trap is effective. You have to trap well. You can't just trap like, oh, we're trapping. Let me go out and wave my arms.
Yep. You remember, I think we might have talked about it in one of the last podcasts we were on, but that's true of every superstar in this league. If you give it 85 or 90% as opposed to really going all out with it, we watched, who was it, the Hawks that tried to trap James Harden earlier in the season. They were doing that thing at half court and they were standing behind the line as if they were, you know, as if their feet were going to burn if they stepped over half court and stepped on the lava. And Harden just ripped them apart. And I mean, like, that's a little bit different because you're talking about trapping, you know, really, really aggressively and not necessarily a half court sort of thing with him or Dame. But you can't give guys space. I mean, we've seen Luka make impossible passes with no window. And so you certainly can't do it giving him some window. And so, yeah, that's the thing. And on the point about the Clippers, it's crazy to think how close that series was to being over in five, or, you know, the Clippers winning that game without Luka's game winner there. On the one hand, like how close they were to finishing that series up, not easily, but I guess quickly. But also on the other hand, that the Clippers really got pushed in that series. And my take on it, and maybe this is a little bit biased just because I've said already that I think the Clippers will win the whole thing. That's the sort of battle that I don't think they're going to really have going forward in the playoffs. Like, I think that Luka was such kind of a singular challenge for the Clippers as far as maybe not having a perfect player. I don't know if anybody really has a perfect player to guard Luka. But, you know, the other guys that they're going to have to face, especially if they go against the Lakers, you figure that they kind of have people out there that should be able to guard somewhat capably their talent, but just didn't really seem to have any, certainly not a convenient answer to guard Luka Doncic.
Well, the thing about the Lakers' talent is that it's the same thing with Bam against Giannis, which is about to start. You can guard those guys. Like, you can guard LeBron and you can guard Anthony Davis, but you can't really. Like, you're not going to stop those guys. Those guys are going to get their numbers. They're going to have – even if you defend them well, they're going to have two games in a series like they did against Portland in Game 5 where they put up a million points on 100% shooting, basically, because they're just that good. And just like as great as Bam is, Giannis is going to have games where he goes for 35 and 15 and 7 because he's just that good. But I agree with you. I think the Clippers should have an easier time in the next round, whether it's whoever wins this series between Utah and Denver. I'm glad you brought up the Rockets because all of this stuff about how do you defend these guys, this and that. Well, the Rockets, I mean, really the best answer is to do what the Rockets do, which is to get really good at switching everything. Mm-hmm. And I think the Rockets' defense against Oklahoma City, with the exception of their meltdown toward the end of Game 4, has been really, really good. And that's the answer, really. Like, when you see them take Gobert out of the pick and roll and hide him on Torrey Craig, that's the answer the Jazz are searching for, is switching. When you see teams monkey around with the matchups like this, they want to switch. Well, Houston does that as a scheme. And, yeah, you give up some stuff in terms of size mismatches and rebounding maybe. But if you commit to that scheme and you practice it and you get good at it, I think it becomes really powerful in the playoffs. Do you want to hear my lukewarm Houston take?
Do I? Let's hear it.
I say this very cautiously and very fearfully. If the Rockets get out of this series, I think they should beat the Lakers. That is not me picking the Rockets, because I do not trust them at all. And everything that I distrust about them happened in Game 4 against Oklahoma City when they blew a 20-point lead. Their transition defense was abysmal. James Harden was trying to hug people in transition and trying to play defense instead of trying to play defense and getting burned for it. Their shot selection was bad. And the Rockets will tell you, well, that's just our shot selection. That's the way we play. Yeah, but okay, you're up 20 with a ticking clock. Maybe try and do some other stuff. I just fundamentally can't trust this team. But when I look at them, if Russ is healthy, I think player for player – they can go head-to-head. They are deeper, and they don't have – you know, Harden is probably somewhere between LeBron and Davis in the all-around pecking order. Both LeBron and Davis are better than Russ, and I don't think it's all that close. But Russ has been outstanding this year. But I think Houston's depth and system I just think they're as good as the Lakers, and they have a really good chance to beat them. And yet I don't think I can bring myself to trust them because – I'm not sure I trust Harden in mega games. And when is the last time a LeBron team lost before the finals? It just never happens. It's hard to envision it happening. But who is guarding James Harden for the Lakers? And the answer, of course, is that no one can actually guard James Harden. But, like, it's different if you have a guy who can at least sort of make it difficult versus when he gets Shai Gilgeous-Alexander on him, he's just rolling to the rim. Who's guarding him for the Lakers? Now, you can make the same argument about, you know, who's PJ Tucker can only guard one of LeBron and Anthony Davis, and he might get tired doing that. Covington will guard the other. They'll switch everything, this and that. So you can make the same argument the other way. I just really like the Rockets. I think they're playing really well. And yet they're not even through the first round. because Oklahoma City is good and I can't trust them. But that's my lukewarm Rockets take. They can beat the Lakers, and I almost think they should. And if they get rolled in that series, I'm going to be very disappointed if they even get there.
Well, let me just say this, and this is not a hot take. I feel like for whatever reason, the last couple of podcasts, I feel like I've rarely had a hot take. But what I'll say, the Rockets are clearly more unpredictable than anybody. The Lakers, which it was really weird how much was coming out, you know, a lot of the morning talk shows and stuff like that, the idea of, the Lakers might lose, you know, Barkley saying that, you know, he thought the Lakers would lose in the first round. No, I mean, that was never going to happen. That was kind of silly to think that, regardless of how well Dame was playing, let alone once Dame got hurt. But what I'll say, as talented as they are, obviously, I still am not completely sold on the Lakers offense. I mean, they obviously struggled in the bubble.
They can't get easy buckets in transition. They're beatable. And again, do I trust the Rockets to build a wall in transition the way the Celtics are doing against the Raptors, which we'll talk about? No, I don't. But if you can make the Lakers earn it in the half court, they're vulnerable against the best teams.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's enough there. There's certainly enough defense. There's certainly enough offense to where they can do it. I don't know if I would go as far as to say should, but I also know that when I say that and when I stop myself from saying that, that a lot of it is built into what you just brought up with the idea of like, but it's LeBron. And that's not really a great rationale.
Yes, it is. It is. It is a great rationale. It's LeBron. It's like saying it's Michael Jordan. It's the same thing.
It is until it's not. And I mean, I think that's all I'm thinking is that this Laker team is flawed enough without being at full strength. You know, without having the defenders that you would want, ideally. I mean, like you said, there's not really an ideal James Harden defender. If there is, you know, you would want him to shoot better than 0-for-9 or whatever Lu Dort might give you. So, I mean, there's enough on both sides of it to think that it should be competitive. I would be disappointed.
Put it this way. I emailed a bunch of people around the league or texted a bunch of people around the league. Some of them thought I was nuts. Pelton emailed me back saying, well, how many efficient games like Harden just played in game five against Oklahoma City? How many of those is he going to give you? And I think his implication was if he doesn't do that 4 to 5 times, they're not winning the series. Others were more toward me. I think that's a coin flip series. I think Houston is good enough to make that a coin flip series. And if they don't perform like that, I think there's going to be some analysis to come out of it. But we are getting ahead of ourselves and we are getting ahead of the Thunder. Let's talk about game 7 more between Utah and Denver. I think as sexy as the Jamal Murray thing is and the Mitchell thing is, you are right that it is unsustainable, which is not a hot take. These guys are not going to score 40 and make every shot every single game. And so you want to say, I don't want to overreact. Royce O'Neal is actually doing a pretty decent job on Jamal Murray, which is incredible to say. He's not playing bad defense, not playing great defense, but he's not playing bad defense. And Rudy Gobert is Rudy Gobert. I don't really want to come out of what has made me this good all season long. However, I do think there's only one game. And if he's hot, you don't get to play the big picture. The playoffs is a small sample size. Every playoff series is a small sample size. I do think they will amp up the aggression, and I think that, again, mixing it up is the answer, but mixing it up, leaning toward taking the ball out of his hands, I think that's probably the right call just because I've got to see Torrey Craig keep making shots. He's at 40% something from three. I've got to see Jeremy Grant, the unsung hero of this series. I got to see him make more shots. Gary Harris, I've got to see those guys make shots. I think Mike Malone has done a really good job finding lineups game by game that give the Nuggets the best chance to have like a little bit of two-way balance. Gary Harris really helped last night. Just having another competent, you know, wing defender to get in passing lanes to make the right reads really helped. I'm interested to see how much he can give them in game 7. But he's had a shaky shooting season. The problem is if you trap him and you let Jokic play 4-on-3, they might get dunked. So I don't know. You just have to load up on Jokic and make those guys hit threes. And the game may come down to like, do those Denver players who are out shooting expectations, do they keep hitting threes?
Yeah. While you were talking about this, I just went to Second Spectrum and I wanted to look at how high above expectations these guys are shooting so far. Obviously, like you said, it's unsustainable.
Did your computer just light on fire?
Yes. And the funniest thing is that Donovan Mitchell is not even the player shooting the highest above his expectations. It's actually Conley so far.
He's making ridiculous shots.
He is. It's really funny too. I'm going to give the game away here a little bit, but I've done it on Twitter already. So whatever. I mean, it's funny. You, me, like people ask all the time. I'm being from Chicago. You know, I wrote about the Knicks. I'm working on a Knicks book. Are you a fan of the Knicks? Are you a fan of the Bulls? No, I don't really care. I haven't in a really, really long time. The only time I care, I would say this as a journalist, is that I always care. I just want to write the best stories I can. So sometimes I kind of find myself rooting for a good story and something that allows me to work on a good story. No reporter wants to be three quarters of the way done with a big feature or something, and then, you know, a player gets hurt or, you know, a series gets too far out of hand to where the story makes sense anymore. I went into this series with like a story idea about the Nuggets, a big feature I wanted to do on them, that, you know, as they fell behind 3-1, it's like, okay, well, that's not going to happen. And then I launched full steam ahead with the idea of watching Conley come back from the birth of his child and being on fire, similar to, well, maybe not similar to Fred VanVleet last year, but certainly making us think about that, making some of us think about that. So I've launched full scale into the idea of like researching all the players that have become fathers that have had children in the last 3 or 4 years, compiled a full list as best I could, have a coworker working with me on it to try to track what happens with players after they have children, shortly after they have children. And now it's like, it's kind of a weird spot because now whoever wins, I'll be able, probably be able to do one of those two stories either way. But it's weird because it's, the series has kind of had me going from one emotion to the other of like, damn, I got to scrap all this work I've been doing.
But didn't some Reddit user once track all of J.R. Smith's games in like the New York Knicks noon tip-off game on Sundays and find that he performed like markedly worse? I feel like you're doing the inverse of that.
I know, good Lord, going back, I know I did something along those lines too. Not just that, but I know at one point I found that he, I can't remember what days of the week it was. I think it was games that were on Saturday, either Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, or games that were on Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So like after a weekend, basically, like when you imagine that people would maybe go out or have a good time or allow themselves to have a better time, that he had the biggest drop-off percentage-wise in the league of any wing player in terms of like his effective field goal percentage from basically the beginning and middle of the week to like the weekend and how far his numbers dropped off. And it was like that for 2 or 3 consecutive years, if I remember, based on the research that I looked, which I was like, I believe in coincidences, but I don't think that is one.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes! Catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems with nothing on your roof. So who's there up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, watch out for them. You name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit directtv.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
What have you seen from Denver to at least mitigate the damage Utah's offense is doing in the last couple of games? And again, some of it is that they have brought Michael Porter Jr. off the bench and started Monte Morris, who hasn't been very good defensively either in his place. But having Michael Porter Jr. guard bench guys mitigates the damage, although he has been a very good crunch time performer playing full fourth quarters in the last couple of games. What else have you seen? How are they faring a little better, and what can the Jazz do?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly Porter Jr. I'm trying to remember who it was. I think it was Michael Pena who posted just this ridiculous clip a few days ago of Porter looking so bad, just kind of on the block, kind of on the post at one point, someone kind of throwing a pump fake of a pass and Porter just jumping wildly in the middle of nowhere for it and then rushing out to the corner when the skip pass is made.
going. I know the play. I can close my eyes and see the play. I will say he's been better the last two games. He's right. been more attentive. He hasn't been out of place much, and the Nuggets have done a better job of not just giving up and having him switch onto Donovan Mitchell and the other guys that they're trying to get him switched onto.
Right. So that helps. I mean, certainly Michael Malone, and I like to kind of see a pattern before I really lay into guys. I remember one of the times that we podcasted earlier in the year, one of my criticisms was of the fact that, you know, he was so late in ordering, adding Porter to the rotation in the first place. It felt like he kind of went late to the idea of not having Jokic drop as frequently or as much or as far. And then once he decided to kind of make that switch or they made that adjustment, they found themselves coming back from a big deficit in that game. So there, you know, that obviously is part of it. Gary Harris, who, you know, man, I feel like a lot of us had written him off and maybe rightfully so. It looked like maybe he was going to be too injured to be part of the series. Having him back out there, just someone who is capable and kind of knows what he's doing, who's smart, that obviously makes a difference. And that's the crazy thing is that even with that, the Jazz still are able to score quite a bit, but all those things make enough of a difference to where you take that and you take what Murray has been doing, and it's enough to keep them in a game and win them a game. So it makes for a fun series. The fact that, you know, there've been a few adjustments made, and the fact that obviously the Nuggets having a guy that's been so inconsistent over the years be lava for the last couple games or for the whole series, really, it makes it a more interesting series. It makes for enough offense on both sides now.
The crazy thing about him going lava is that Gobert, and this is partly the Nuggets by choice because Murray is going lava, but it's partly because of Gobert. Jokic's post game has been a total non-factor for most of the series. Like, he's barely even trying to post up. He's basically a pick and pop jump shooter because they're running so much of the offense through Murray. But Jokic does his job. He's been very good. I thought Denver last night was better at making the Jazz ball handlers, both Mitchell and Clarkson, see a body, an extra body, a third body at the rim earlier. They had guys in the restricted area earlier, and I think they bet on these guys are going to try to score, and they're not going to make the simple play. They're not going to make the simple kickout pass, and I think Utah missed 8, 9, 10, 12 pretty simple play kind of passes that Quinn Snyder is going to show them film and be like, when they load on you like this, that dude's open and that dude's open. Just trust the pass. Make the pass. But they've done a better job at seeing. And about Jokic, you know, I've never really liked or believed in the Jokic blitzing thing, even though that's what Denver has mostly done for the last couple of years. I thought their defense was a little bit, which I think they were 10th in defense last year. I thought it was a little bit fool's gold. And their defense has been awful since the last 50 games. But if he can't, I've come to understand that if him dropping back is just providing no resistance, if it doesn't matter that he drops back, like, you still get the rim, you still get threes because they have to help, you get everything, then I have nothing left to say other than the aggressive scheme as a default is probably better for Denver, provided you have enough weak side defenders who can execute what you need to execute behind that play. And with Harris back and Craig and Grant making shots, they have that. And, you know, I wonder, one thing I would do if I was Utah is I would attack Millsap more. I'm not emotionally prepared to talk about how bad Paul Millsap has looked in this
That's
series.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
It's so bad. And when they've attacked him, he's had no shot in the pick and roll. And then you have Jokic waiting on the back line to, again, provide no resistance. That's something I would look at. I even wonder, the ballsiest move on the board for Mike Malone is to not start Paul Millsap. Hmm. I think they're like minus 50 or 45. I looked it up before with Millsap on the floor. Like, their starting lineup is just getting killed. He has the worst plus minus on the team by a lot. That's a pretty gutsy move in game 7.
You sunk my battleship there because I was literally like about to say that. I actually think in a lot of ways that's kind of been the difference is that, like you said, I know at one point I wrote about them moving away from the drop defense and trying to have him play a little bit further up more often. But also mentioning in that same story that like this probably isn't totally sustainable for them either. Like we both said, you have to go with a mix of different strategies to try to contain what Utah's doing. But a big part of what's just not working for them anymore It's just like one of the best fundamental players in the league for a long time. Whether it's that, whether it's aging, whether it's just slowing down, Millsap just hasn't been the defender that we've always kind of been used to, and not having him kind of be there to back up or not getting there quickly enough. Or, you know, maybe it's that Jokic has just been so out of position and so slow that Millsap can't cover for it this time. But yeah, I normally wouldn't have thought of Utah as a team that's just dicing up people like this. I know Mitchell is extremely talented, but Millsap has been a big chunk of that. And there have been times where he's kind of looked unplayable from that standpoint. And it certainly has been a contributing factor to everything.
Part of what you can do on offense is mix it up too. And if they're going to trap with Jokic and they're getting in a rhythm of that, well, then bring Millsap's guy up to set a pick. And is he going to trap? Is he going to hedge? Does he not really know what he wants to do? And then you can attack that way. Similarly, I thought Denver on offense got a couple of really great looks out of timeouts when they used Jamal Murray as a screener. And that's something I would go back to, because they're going to be so focused on Murray that if they can sneak in six or seven possessions where he sets a ball screen and flares out and it catches the defense off guard, that can be powerful for Denver. For Utah, I just think they got a little caught up in one-on-one play in game six. They need to rev up their machine a little bit more, get some guys flying off picks before they get the ball, all that Utah-y stuff. I still am going to pick the Jazz to win game seven if you force me to make a pick. It would be in Denver, but it's not. But I mean, Jamal Murray, if you told me Jamal Murray scores 90 points in game seven, I'd be like, oh, it makes sense. So anyway, if you gun to your head, who would you pick?
I think I would go with Utah, just because I think beating them three times in a row would be difficult, you know, even taking the home away part out of it. I just kind of figured when it got to 3-1 that, you know, maybe Denver gets the game here. I'm impressed that they've taken it to a seventh game after all that. But I mean, I don't feel really strongly one way or the other. And I think it's kind of hard to, given how hot Mitchell and Murray have both been. And quite frankly, you know, if one guy just falls back to earth a little bit and the other one doesn't, then that would be enough to get game seven.
If only starting your fitness journey was as easy as starting this podcast. The truth is, all the lift big, get big, and beach body ready in 3 weeks pressure stops most of us from even starting. And starting is what matters most. It's everything. Wherever you're beginning, wherever you want to be, Peloton encourages you to just start. With thousands of classes to get you moving and doing what you can. If that's a 10-minute low impact class, they've got those. And when you're ready, take it up a gear with a 30-minute live DJ ride. Start with Peloton and find instructors that will keep you motivated to stay on your fitness journey. Learn the basics and build from there. Remember, doing something is everything. Get started with a Peloton bike or bike plus rental at onepeloton.com/bike/rentals. Terms apply. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because of the eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The Low Post fans, listen up. Have you heard you can listen to episodes of this very show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership? That's right. All your favorite The Low Post episodes can be heard on Amazon Music ad-free. But that's not all. You can listen to other top podcasts like First Take and Pardon the Interruption ad-free as well. They also have favorite shows like The Daily, Part of My Take, and Up First, all without ads. You know what this means? Uninterrupted listening. So no more cliffhangers. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts, so we know they definitely have something for you. And it's already included in your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/low. That's amazon.com/low to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's flip to Celtics Raptors. Celtics cruised in game one, won by a lot. Did you make a pick in this series? And if so, what was your pick?
I did. We had the same pick, and it was one I was not expecting to make. I, for months now, had been saying that Toronto kind of seemed to be the team that, you know, was worth really keeping a close eye on if it wasn't going to be Milwaukee. If you don't believe in Milwaukee, kind of here's why Toronto is that team instead. I felt that really solidly, really strongly. And the more I kind of looked into stuff as I was researching the series, you and I were going to record this podcast last week before before the strike happened and everything. I kind of changed my opinion on it. I went Celtics in seven. And quite frankly, a performance like what we saw yesterday, you know, if anything, it probably looked like maybe you'd want to pick the Celtics in fewer games than seven. But it was just one game. But at the same time, the Celtics kind of beat the brakes off the Raptors in the last game that they played against each other in the bubble as well.
I also picked Celtics in seven. We have the same thing. I said this on a previous podcast. I think in the aggregate, Toronto is a slightly better team than Boston. But I think this matchup is problematic for the Raptors. And that one game in the bubble inspired me to look a little bit more deeply at the head-to-head games and the head-to-head matchup and why it looks problematic for Boston. And that convinced me to pick Boston. Had Hayward been healthy, I would have gone Boston in six. I think Hayward being out is a big deal because, A, obviously, you know, all of these minutes that are going to Semi-Ojale or, you know, whoever ends up playing those minutes, maybe Romeo Langford makes a cameo here and there. Those are all Hayward minutes, and you're much better off, obviously, with Hayward. Number two, you know, if the Raptors ever do play the card of Siakam at center, which we saw for a hot second when game one was out of hand, if they conclude that Gasol and Ibaka are at a disadvantage in defending Boston's pick and roll game, or they just are providing nothing on offense, Gasol's been bad most of the playoffs, that's a card in their deck. And Boston's response to that would just be, we'll just put our five best players on the floor. And they don't have one of their five best players. But, well, I'll ask you, why do you like this matchup a little bit for Boston? Before I even do that, let's just put the brakes on for a second. You know, we should know by now that you don't overreact to game one. You know, right. Just like everyone went crazy. The Lakers lost, the Bucks lost, everything's in chaos. Then
you can't even overreact to half anymore. I mean, we watched these teams have these massive 20-point comebacks, you know. So yeah, you're right.
So Boston won by 18. Let's call it a 23-point win before garbage time.
Okay.
I think really Boston won by 8. And what I mean by that is Boston 17 of 39 from 3. Toronto 10 of 40. This was a make-miss game to some degree. I'm not discrediting what the Celtics did. We're going to talk about why we both picked them. We obviously like this matchup for them. But this was a little bit of a make-miss game. And to prove that point, our friends at Second Spectrum have this little fancy thingamajigger that quantifies what teams would be expected to shoot in each game based on where the shots are coming from and who's taking them. So it's not just a blind like metric that treats Steph Curry like Tony Allen or something like that. And in both versions of that metric, the one that is blind and the one that isn't, Toronto had better shots than Boston in game one. Toronto's expected effective field goal percentage, 55.2, Boston's 53.3. Obviously, it did not work out that way. I thought Toronto missed a ton of good threes in the first half as the game was slipping away. That said, why did you, Chris Herring, like this matchup? Just a teensy bit for Boston.
I have a lot of questions about Siakam. As much as I love him, he's one of my favorite players in the league to watch.
Don't make me kick you off the podcast now.
I don't know that I trust Toronto's wing players enough in this series when you consider what they're going up against from a scoring standpoint. And so when I say that, you know, Siakam, as great as he is, I feel like this is really the first time where he's going to be playing against an opponent that's equal or maybe slightly better as really a number one option. Obviously didn't have to do that last year. This last series was one where they were expected to win. And now, you know, you've got a situation where he's going to be expected to create probably a decent amount of one-on-one offense or at least offense where he's kind of the number one option. And he's not been great. When he has to kind of come up with his own offense this season, particularly against better opponents and opponents that are 500 or better. So there's that. Then you add in the fact that, you know, initially I felt even more strongly about the pick because Lowry was coming off of the gimpy ankle. But
anything was going to sway you last minute to bite your tongue and pick against the Raptors, that was it.
Right. So that was a big part of it. And really it was an even bigger part of it than it would have been, in part because Van Vliet is not the greatest finisher. It's probably one of the weaker parts of his game is finishing at the basket. And in particular, so, you know, you look at drives and how often he drives and guys that drive as much as he does. I think he had the second worst field goal percentage at the rim this season in the regular season. And he was considerably worse than that against the Celtics in games this season, where I think he was like slightly less than 30% finishing at the rim on drives this year. And so you basically take all those things into account, and it's like, okay, maybe a gimpy Kyle, and you need him and VanVleet to step up more perhaps if this is Siakam's really first go-round being a number one option against a pretty elite defense and a team that is your equal. And so it's like, okay, those are the three guys you're relying on most, and we don't know what we're going to get from them.
Well, when you can put Tatum on Lowry and Jaylen Brown and some Marcus Smart on Pascal Siakam, you're off to a pretty good start. And Siakam, 10 post-ups in game one, less than a point per possession. Boston basically left him alone and let him take little flippy shots that didn't go in. They'll live with that all day long. The main reason, I think, other than what the size on the wing that I just mentioned, there were two things. Number one, and most importantly, Boston was the number one transition defense in the league, according to Cleaning the Glass, and right. it was not close. And you watch Daniel Theis form that wall in transition, and it's usually he's almost – remember they did the thing a couple seasons ago where they were holding hands trying to form their wall against Ben
with
Simmons?
With Giannis? Oh, yeah.
Was it Giannis or Ben Simmons? It was one of them where they would like literally be holding hands, which is against the rules, I think. I think some nerd pointed out that that's actually technically against the rules. They're really good at that. And if you can vaporize that from Toronto and make them beat you in the half court every team suffers in the half court. That's the nature of basketball. Transition offense is more efficient. The dichotomy is bigger in Toronto's case. And the second thing is Kemba Walker looks awesome.
Man.
All that knee stuff is out the window, although he banged it a little bit last night. Seemed fine. Him and Tatum working the pick and roll against centers who like to drop back a little bit. Now, Mark can come up to the level of the screen. Serge can come up to the level of the screen. Not really their preferred method necessarily. That scares me a little bit. And the last thing I will say is I thought the best thing that Boston did in game one was they got off the ball quickly. With the exception of a couple of Jaylen Brown plays, as my daughter screams in the background, when they had two on the ball, Kemba Walker wasted no time. Slip to Robert Williams, you make the next play. Jason Tatum wasted no time. Swing to the corner, you make the play. Load up on me from the strong side corner, kick to Marcus Smart for corner threes. I think if you hold the ball, the most interesting battle of the series to me is Boston's drive and kick machine against the swarming, rotating menace that is Toronto's defense. And I think Boston can tread water or win that battle if they trust the pass, as Brad Stevens like to say. And I think they did that very well in game one. And a stat that I'm tracking every game, Boston was toward the bottom of the league in corner threes. Toronto famously allows the most corner threes in the history of the NBA. Boston got 15 corner threes in game one, which is like double their average, made 10 of them. And I think that was the product of trusting the pass and good ball movement.
Yeah, it really stood out to me. Jaylen Brown in particular, like you said, making really, really quick decisions in this game. If he's going to shoot right away, he does that. If he's going to put the ball on the deck, he does that. And that really stood out. The other thing that really stood out yesterday too, I think, was that, you know, one of my question marks for this series, you probably come in knowing you're not going to play cancer in this series. You really can't.
I disagree.
Do you?
I think there's a role for Cantor in this series. I'm surprised he didn't play at all in game one, although I've said from the beginning, I think Robert Williams is just flat, more useful, more sort of malleable by matchup. But Toronto is not a good defensive rebounding team. And, you know, if Ibaka is going to shoot threes like he did in game one, it does become a little bit of an issue. But I think Cantor can steal some minutes in this series if he hits the glass hard. But well, anyway, continue.
The thing is, if Robert Williams, Time Lord's going to play the way he did yesterday, I don't think there are minutes for cancer. I mean, I think
Time Lord was outstanding.
You can make the argument for sure that there should be or that there could be if he's not as effective as he was yesterday, or if you see an opportunity to really crash the boards there. But yeah, he was fantastic, and that was kind of what I was curious to see is when he gets minutes, what does he do with them? And he was just so active yesterday. You know, a couple of really nasty blocks that he had, a couple of really nice plays underneath the rim. In transition. So I don't know that game. I mean, it's certainly, like you said, it's just one game. I mean, this is a team that has a championship pedigree that we're talking about in Toronto. But between this game and how good the Celtics looked from the jump, even, I mean, they came out and jumped all over Toronto. Between that and the last game they played, which, you know, was not for all the marbles, it was a bubble game. You know, it looks convincing, and it'll be interesting to see what Toronto comes out with. You know, if ever there's been a team that really makes adjustments from one game to the next, sometimes one half to the next, it's Toronto. And so there's by no means is it, you know, a knockout blow or anything like that. But it was, this is what you wanted to see if you're a Celtics fan or if you're the Celtics.
I think they're going to have to try to attack Kemba Walker a little bit more on defense. And in the regular season, they ran a lot of Lowry, Van Fleet, two-man games. Kemba's always guarding Van Fleet. The Siakam-Van Fleet pick and roll was a weapon for them in the regular season to, again, try to get Walker involved, try to get switches, just try to get – he's the weak link on their defense, the only weak link, really. Try to attack him. They will – also, obviously, they'll make shots. Toronto's bench has to beat Boston's bench handily in this series, I think. And in game one, it was disappointing. And there are little things here and there. And look, you know, you just said it. Nick Nurse is not going to waste time. He's not going to mess around. He's going to make adjustments. He's going to make adjustments we don't necessarily expect. One of the wild ideas I had coming into this series is if Boston starts hurting them with pull-up jump shots on the pick and roll, and they're the best pull-up shooting team in the league, by the way, would he try to hide Marcus Sol on Marcus Smart for stretches of games, the way he had Marcus Sol guard Jay Crowder against Miami in one bubble game so that they could switch the Bam Adebayo pick and rolls. I wonder, I mean, that sounds crazy, but Nick Nurse does crazy things. I actually don't think it's that crazy. I also think it's only a matter of time before we see Anunoby guard Jason Tatum a lot more than he did in game one. Tatum didn't really kill and Lowry, like, good luck if you're going to try and isolate against Kyle Lowry. But I think I just think you have to weaponize OG Anunoby a little bit more. And I know they like to weaponize their guys as health defenders, right? Guard Marcus Smart, but really don't guard him and muck a lot of stuff up. I think that's something to look forward to.
You know, I don't know. I came in, obviously, like I said, I picked Celtics in seven. Nick Nurse will make adjustments. He always does. It's what makes him special. But there were some stuff in that game that I, you know, like I said, if anything, off that game and the last one that they played in the bubble against each other, I, you know, this was one of those where, like, maybe I should have picked Celtics in six. Jason Tatum did not have a point or a rebound, I don't think, until, like, the end of the first quarter. And the score by that point was 34-17 when he got his first point. That just scares me a little bit because I just kind of went into this thinking, look, this is a pretty even matchup. When you have that and it's kind of a toss-up, maybe you just go with the best player in the series. And, you know, I think you could obviously make the argument that he is the best player in the series, that Tatum is. If not him, then maybe it's Kemba by a small margin. Maybe you feel really good about Lowry or Siakam and you feel that way. But the idea that he, you know, that he wasn't even a huge factor early on and that they were playing as well as they were, and even with that, they could have been up by more than that. There was a play where – Jaylen Brown, I think, stepped out of bounds and had a three that he hit that they called out of bounds. There were like a couple plays like that where Boston could have had a bigger lead than they did, and they were already just kind of mollywopping the Raptors over the head. So I don't know. It's just one game. It's just one moment. But, I did have in my notes that Anunoby clearly stood out as one of the guys that looked pretty comfortable with yesterday's game as far as offensively. You could certainly use him more given that he's not – being asked to create that much offense for you to throw him on Tatum a little bit more.
I will say, obviously, Nick Nurse already tried zone, heavy look of zone. It worked in game one. Not a big believer that that's going to cause Boston a huge amount of trouble when their best shooters are on the floor. Nor am I a big believer that the supersized Siakam, Ibaka, Gasol is the answer. Maybe I'm just too skeptical of like super duper big lineups now. You know, maybe I just am too skeptical of it. But I think Boston is so fast with enough shooting. Now, obviously, you when you play big, they played zone to sort of mitigate the amount of moving around all the big guys had to do. But I don't know if that's the answer for them. The first answer is to make shots. Boston, to me, still has some cards to play, too. Like, I would use Tatum. And there are a lot of ways they can use Tatum if he's got a smaller guy on him. And I don't mean just ISO him. I mean set some cross screens for him under the rim. Use him as a screener in the pick and roll to try and force some kind of uncomfortable switches for them. You know, the Kemba, Jason Tatum, two-man game, they barely tapped that. And Michael Pena wrote about that today. Boston has just destroyed teams when they have two guys set staggered screens for Kemba.
Right.
And the first guy is like a bigger wing, whether it's Jaylen Brown. They did it to Al Horford via Jaylen Brown in the first round. And then Tice. And they just have gotten switches and confused teams. And Kemba has walked into easy threes. They did not play that card hardly at all in game one. So I do think this is going to be a long series, though. I think Toronto's bench is going to have much better games, and Boston's bench is going to have much worse games. And I think Lowry, Van Vliet, what was Van Vliet? Some horrendous shooting figure in game one, right? 3 of 16. I think those guys are going to respond. I am looking forward to a really nip and tuck series, but I find this a very, very – I mean, we've been waiting for this series for 5 years. We finally got it.
The second round, man, it's weird to say that the first round hasn't been good, however you want to phrase it.
It's still going on. It's so weird.
Because it's had moments. Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, it's been strange for any number of reasons, obviously. The bubble, what we had last week with the strike. But just the matchups, too. I mean, you have games that are so lopsided, but then you have games that look lopsided, and then the other team comes back and takes the lead or wins. And so it's like – it's the first time I've ever sat and watched like 30-point blowouts from beginning to end almost, because I don't feel comfortable turning the games off. But also, you know, you get games like that and you get series that still ultimately end up 4-2 or 4-1 or what have you. So it hasn't been a terrible first round, but it hasn't been great. But you've had moments that kind of will stick with you, and you've had really standout performances. So this is a matchup. The second round should be really, really great, and I'm looking forward to that. Really don't know exactly what to expect, but the matchups on paper look fantastic.
We don't know who's going to play the Lakers yet.
That's true.
It's been, I just love that Denver just can't play anything but a 7-game barn burner in the playoffs. Do you think, let me ask you this, do you think anyone within the Warriors organization is secretly, and they'll never admit it publicly, is secretly hoping Denver comes back to win so they're not the most recent team to blow a 3-1 lead? Do you think that thought has entered like Steph Curry's mind or Bob Myers' mind or Joe Lacob's mind, so that every time someone's up 3-1, it doesn't show like asterisk last team to blow a 3-1 lead, 2016 Golden State Warriors? I bet somebody is.
Only thinking about it if they're listening to your podcast. I'll put it that way. But
no, I don't believe it. I think some petty, sad individual within the Warriors organization. That's sad.
That blown lead was so bad and so monumental that I just kind of feel like even when someone becomes the next team to do it, you still should list the Warriors as the last team to do it just because it was the finals and it counts for more. But yeah.
It counts for a lot more than blowing it in a first round series that the Clippers are probably going to render irrelevant anyway in about 10 days. But any last reflections on this, or have we got everything you wanted to hit on these two series?
I think that's everything for me, man. I'm interested to keep watching, but yeah, I hope Toronto puts up more of a fight. But like I said,
they will. No. This is gonna be a long series.
I hope so. I'll be a little disappointed if it's 4 or even 5, because I think that this one should be. Or I'm sorry,
four?
Not 4.
Are you crazy?
I meant to say 5 or 6. I'm sorry. I really feel like it on paper should go 7. Part of that is me. Like I said, I thought all year that Toronto was the team Milwaukee needed to be worried about, and the team that could take down Milwaukee. And so part of me just thinks that even though I have the Celtics in the series, that there's no universe in which the Raptors shouldn't go 7 at least. So I'm hoping that it goes the distance, because it, on paper, I think it's the most fun series of this round.
And the only reason we're not talking Bucks Heat right now is because by the time this podcast goes up, there's going to be limited time before Bucks Heat. So there's no point. We'll see how game one plays out. That has the potential to be a very exciting series. Miami is rolling. I think we're exaggerating a little bit the degree to which they're rolling, because the Pacers were undermanned and so bad in the first round that they gave their coach an extension and then fired him 4 games later, or relieved him of his duties. Is that what we say now?
I don't know what the phrasing is. Yeah,
Chris Herring, you are relieved of your duties on the Low Post podcast today. I did not even give you an extension, frankly, as a token gesture.
Did I just get fired?
No, you've just been relieved of your duties, whatever that means. Chris Herring, what can we read from you at 5:38? What do we got? Well, you just mentioned we're going to have a Denver thing of some sort cooking soon, whether it's newborn babies or the Denver Nuggets or both. What else we got?
Me and some coworkers are cooking up something on John Thompson, rest his soul, that should be up later today at some point. And yeah, either something on the Nuggets or something on the Babies that we will frame around Mike Conley and the Jazz.
Man, I'll tell you this. You want, unless you were like a Chris Mullin, Mark Jackson, Derek Coleman kind of star, you wanted nothing to do with Georgetown's defense in their heyday. Absolutely nothing. Just bring in the ball. Or I guess maybe if you were Princeton in the NCAA tournament that one year. But you just wanted nothing to do with them. They were tenacious and in your freaking jersey. So it is a sad loss. And like I said, they are iconic. All right. Thank you, Mr. Herring. I will talk to you soon.
Thank you so much, Zach, for having me as always. Appreciate you.